From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Detroit's chief health executive expresses some tentative optimism about this stage of the battle against COVID.
We have risen to the challenge, and we are still fighting. This pandemic is going to be with us for a very long time, but yet we are headed in the right direction.
Also, what homeschooling has to offer Black families during and after the pandemic.
I try to get the parent to understand that your home isn't the classroom. The whole city is your classroom. Mm-hmm. So they begin to change their paradigm. They don't know where to begin.
And visions of Afrofuturism as seen in American comics.
I like to ask people to think about Afrofuturism as the intersection of speculation and liberation. And in the context of comics, these are stories and characters that have something to say about the future from a Black perspective.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we're going to introduce you to two moms who drew so much out of homeschooling their own children. They've dedicated their professional lives to helping parents thrown into homeschooling by the pandemic.
What does real homeschooling look like? And how do I take control of my own child's education?
That's coming up later in the show. But first, many of our communities are still scrambling to offer enough vaccinations to the first cohort of priority groups: hospital workers, seniors living in congregate settings like nursing homes, and educators. Detroit is one of the cities that's ahead of the curve. The city has just started a series of outreach programs to find seniors who didn't make it to the TCF Center for the first wave of shots. And Mayor Duggan recently added food and beverage workers to the list of priority groups. Now, as we've heard on the show in recent days, Detroit made an important partnership with Quicken Loans to handle the logistics of mass vaccination. But this has been a critical time for the city's health department, too. Denise Fair is Detroit's chief health officer, and she joins us now. Denise, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the realities of the pandemic is the issue that this huge organizational lift is on the shoulders of Michigan's county and city health departments. To your knowledge, has the city ever done anything on this scale, this mass vaccination, before?
Not in my lifetime. So I'm very proud to lead the Detroit Health Department along with 250 experts. This continues to be a challenge to us, but we have risen to the challenge and we are still fighting. This pandemic is going to be with us for a very long time, but yet we are headed in the right direction.
We know that the city has had a partner in this, in Quicken Loans, going back to the days when COVID testing first needed to be done on a pretty massive scale. Can you tell us about the pieces that Quicken and its partners have been able to help with, and which pieces the city continues to oversee and to do?
Sure. So this has been a heavy lift, and we really feel strongly that as a city of Detroit, we have to partner with our trusted community partners. Quicken stepped in immediately to help us at the height of the pandemic, almost a year ago now, with an appointment center, a call center that has helped us to offer testing for all of our residents in the city of Detroit. And now that the vaccine is available, they have been even more helpful. We're now taking about 3,000 calls per day to Detroiters who want to get vaccinated. So it really has been a great partnership with Quicken Loans.
We've heard that one of the challenges of vaccination on this scale is that a pretty high percentage of folks in some of the priority groups are not in a position to, or sometimes not in the habit of, checking email multiple times a day, or, you know, may not have internet access or internet know-how in order to sign up. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the methods that Detroit has taken on to try to make sure that vulnerable populations have more ways of signing up than, you know, maybe just waiting for an email?
Well, let's just talk about equity. And we know that the city has been tackling equity in vaccine distribution. Just a few weeks ago, we were only getting about 50% of the allocation that we requested. But now, in partnership with the Biden administration, as well as the Whitmer administration, we're getting more vaccines so that Detroiters can get vaccinated. We also know that Black and Brown communities are 2 to 3 times more likely to get COVID and also to die from it. So it is imperative that the city removes barriers to provide equitable access to the vaccine. And so now on a consistent basis, we're getting about 15,000 doses of the vaccine every week. And we are making sure that Detroiters who want to get vaccinated can get vaccinated. And so we've done a really great job of getting the word out there through our regular press conferences, through our social media channels, and partnering with our community partners such as DWIN and Wayne Health.
Do you have any sense of how many people who have been vaccinated in Detroit so far were reached by an alternative method, say by a phone call?
No. So I'm not aware. I can tell you right now that 45,000 Detroiters have received the vaccine, and we've done an incredible job of getting the word out there through our press conferences, through our social media channels to let them know that, you know, based upon the category, they are available. So at this point, we are vaccinating any resident in the city of Detroit who is 65 years and older. We're also vaccinating childcare providers, K-12 teachers and support staff, adult foster caregivers, employees of the city of Detroit, the clergy, food and beverage workers living or working in the city of Detroit. So there's a lot of categories that are now available at the TCF Center, and Detroiters are taking advantage of it. There's definitely a high demand. When we first opened the TCF Center, there was about 150,000 callers from Detroiters who wanted to get the vaccine. So we know that the demand is there.
That population of folks 65 and up, that's been a big part of the early priority groups. Have there been ways that the city has been able to reach out and help seniors to make vaccinations happen beyond the communications aspect that we talked about?
Absolutely. So one of the great things that we do in the health department is outreach. In the very first part of receiving the vaccine, we were able to immediately deploy teams into our senior apartments and our homeless shelters. And those are our most vulnerable communities. And so to date, we've already vaccinated over 2,500 seniors and people who are experiencing homelessness.
You mentioned a little bit earlier the state's decision to take another look at how it was dividing up vaccines that are available among Michigan's different regions. And Dr. Joan A. Khaldun, the state's chief medical executive, has talked to us at some length about how that worked and why the decision was made. Since the state did start doing that with an eye for equity and deliveries to Detroit increased, can you tell us a little bit about how much it increased and what that made possible?
So we were only receiving about 50% of the allocation that we requested. And that was limiting our ability to get out into the community. Now we are receiving about 15,000 doses every single week. And so that allows us to administer more shots in arms. And so we're accomplishing this in a variety of different ways. First, we're meeting people where they are. We're partnering with Wayne Health, and we're using their mobile units to go out into the community. We just also announced Senior Saturdays. Seniors age 65 years and older can get the vaccine at two of the largest churches in Detroit, that's Second Ebenezer Church and Fellowship Chapel. So we chose these locations because one is on the west side, the other is on the east side, and we wanted to make it easier for people to get there. So we do plan to vaccinate about 4,000 seniors over the next 4 weeks. So again, we're able to now administer more shots in arms because we have more vaccine.
It seems like Detroit is moving pretty expediently among the priority groups. I saw that people with disabilities and home health care providers have just been added to the pool of folks who are eligible to sign up for vaccinations. The fact that you were able to increase into those areas, is that more about the availability of vaccines that you're getting now, or more about the organizational side of it and how fast shots have been getting into arms?
You know, over the last 2 weeks, Mayor Duggan and I received about 200 letters and phone calls from a number of organizations in the disability community, and they're asking us to prioritize them. And so we responded because we recognize a strong need to protect people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so some of these examples include palsy, Down syndrome, and autism. And so we felt really strongly that we needed to do something about it. So now any Detroiter age 18 and older with intellectual and developmental disabilities can make an appointment right at the TCF Center. And also their caregiver who makes an appointment can also get the vaccine with them. And so again, this is because we want to make sure that we provide an equitable approach for this vaccine.
Denise, we know that the state is not collecting data on the race of people who are receiving vaccinations. Is Detroit collecting that information?
Absolutely. So in the spirit of transparency, we are in the process of inputting data for actual doses administered by both race and ethnicity. And so we hope to have that on our dashboard. It's really important for us to be transparent in the process. And again, that's another way that we can assure Detroiters that we are equitable in our approach to delivering the vaccine to anyone who wants it.
Would you say that what's happened over the past year or so has taught us lessons that we should remember about the importance of public health infrastructure?
Absolutely. People don't really know much about public health unless there is some sort of national disaster. Public health typically is behind the scenes. And this was really the year for public health to be out in the forefront. And I really hope that the state continues to recognize the value of public health infrastructure, making sure we have adequate funding to help support programs, which will ultimately affect the health of our residents.
Denise Fair is Chief Public Health Officer for the Detroit Health Department. Denise, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Wherever you live, we know that you probably still have unanswered questions about the COVID vaccines. This Wednesday, we're going to try to answer as many as we can for you, with help from folks like Wayne County's Chief Health Strategist, Dr. Muhannad Hamami, and Michigan's Chief Health Executive, Dr. Jonay Khaldun. Email your questions right now to stateside@michiganradio.org. If you record one on your phone and email it to us, we might even be able to use it on air. You can also call the Stateside voicemail and leave us a message. The number is 734-764-7840. One more time, that's 734-764-7840. Or just tweet at us, at Stateside Radio. Next up, a virtual exhibition that takes you to Wakanda and beyond, exploring Black superheroes and comics.
These are, for the most part, all independent comics that many people would not have the opportunity to see if they weren't brought to their attention.
That's after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Detroit's great writer and activist Adrienne Marie Brown once pointed out that the experience of Black Americans is, by definition, a story of science fiction and fantasy. Enslaved ancestors had to dream up a Black future that was unlike anything that they themselves experienced. One of our most vital labs for science fiction and fantasy narratives today is in the comics. A new virtual exhibition at Michigan State University's museum lays out a full panorama of Black futures as envisioned in the panels. It's called Beyond Black Panther, Visions of Afrofuturism in American Comics. And its curator is Julian Chambliss. He is an English professor at MSU and also a curator at the museum. Julian, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
I imagine that this exhibition also gave you a place to explore your own passion for comics.
Yeah, I'm a longtime fan of comics. My research is in comics, and this was an opportunity to really think about the definitions around Afrofuturism and the way they rely on, at some level, on comics, and to make that visible through the exhibit.
Now, the exhibition focuses on what it means to have Black characters and Black creators, of course, but also true Afrofuturism as a basis for stories. What does Afrofuturism mean in the context we're using it here?
Right. So I like to ask people to think about Afrofuturism as the intersection of speculation and liberation. And in the context of comics, these are stories and characters that have something to say about the future from a Black perspective. And Afrofuturism, in the definition that was sort of coined in the 1990s, really put a lot of emphasis on Afrofuturism as a sort of thought process, as a sort of philosophy in the pages of Black created and Black drawn comics. At the time, the example that the Mark Derry, the theorist that coined the term, was using was Milestone Comics, which is a very famous comic book company of the early 1990s. It's associated with Dwayne McDuffie, who is with the school, University of Michigan. And those characters really highlighted the full scope of the possibilities around a kind of Black futurity. And this emphasis that Derry put on Black-owned and Black-written comics really inspired me to sort of think about what does that mean in a more historically robust context, right? And so one of my goals with this exhibit, I hope to inspire people to want to do more with Black comics. And so our goals here are to get people to think about this idea that Black visions of the future run a really robust set of different pathways that are united around certain thematic concerns.
Yeah. I want to talk about that a little bit more, but if we could return to Milestone Media for a moment, could you, for those who aren't familiar, could you lay out Milestone's origin story, as it were?
Sure. Milestone was a comic book imprint that was owned by several Black creators, so sort of principals are Dennis Cohen, Mark Dingell, and Dwayne McDuffie. Christopher Priest was involved in early stages. This was a company that all these creators had worked in comics. And so they created a whole story world called Dakota, the Dakotaverse. And they set, and Dakota is basically Detroit. One of the things I write about in comics is like, you know, comics are an archive of the American experience. And comics and cities are really tightly connected. And so many comic book cities are referencing real places. In Dakota's context, it's Detroit. They just accept it.
We're fortunate to live in this era when the Marvel movie Black Panther brought an Afrofuturist vision to full-color panoramic life. It's just, it's an amazing film. But at the same time, the title of the exhibition, Beyond Black Panther, hints that this is about more than just Marvel doing an Afrofuturist movie with Ryan Coogler. Could you say more about that?
Right. So one of the things that I wanted to do, and as the title sort of indicates, is that we want to push beyond the sort of idea that Black Panther represents the singular vision of Afrofuturism in comics. And our goal in this exhibit was to try to signal to people that there are many different Black-owned comics that engage in future-oriented narratives or engage in what we can understand as sort of Black speculative practice, that they're considering Black past, present, and future through stories that are rooted in the experience of the African diaspora and take into account and present stories and characters that represent a complexity connected to that diaspora, right? So these are, for the most part, all independent comics that many people would not have the opportunity to see if they weren't, you know, brought to their attention because of the nature of the comic book industry, which is still in many ways a very niche industry. The characters that we know that dominate popular culture are characters that are very old, but they're also not unimportantly connected to major corporate media conglomerates, right? So they're in a position to put those characters to use in a kind of multimedia digital streaming environment. So these are creators and characters that are no less inventive, no less adventurous in what they're doing. But unless you go to very specialized places, you're not going to see them. And so the goal of sort of jumping off from some of the ideas represented in Black Panther, Marvel's Black Panther, the film and the comic, and thinking, you know, this idea is there. This idea is also here in this comic that you probably haven't heard of.
What are some of the key concepts that you feel like we ought to be looking for that might suggest an Afrofuturist ethos?
Right. So, you know, a lot of Afrofuturism futurist theorists will point us to some recurring themes that unite Afrofuturism. One is an aesthetic. So when you see something that's Afrofuturist, one thing that jumps out is that there's an aesthetic that speaks to a kind of African context, tribal context, space. There's colors, themes, and textures that unite Afrofuturism that are drawn not from a European modernist context, but from perhaps an Afro-diasporic context that is more natural, less industrial, more greens, more orange, more red versus more metal, gray, things like that. So there's that. There's a metaphysics, a spirit element that's very important. I think a lot of Afrofuturism speaks to a kind of spiritual practice, not necessarily rooted in a Judeo-Christian perspective, but in fact rooted in other faith beliefs that we might associate with the African experience. And here, this question of ancestors, spirit, and memory all tied up in that space of the metaphysical. In the Black Panther film, the spirit plane that T'Challa goes to talk to his father and see his ancestors, that's an example of this whole spiritual practice. But much of African American and much of African folklore speaks very, very strongly about the importance of ancestors, about the importance of them still being with you, about them not going away, and the practices that maintain them as part of your everyday life. There's also this question of science. Much of our sense of modernity is rooted in a European understanding of science. What does it mean for us to think about really the long and complex history of African thought and practice and its contributions to science? And in the American context, and I'm careful to recognize that this comic book driven show is an American comic book driven show. There are real contributions made by people of color that are obscured in the narrative of progress and innovation in the American experience. And so this is a place where we can have some attention drawn. And then, of course, the question of community is also very important.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking today with Julian Chambliss, professor of English at Michigan State University. He's also a curator of history at the MSU Museum. His latest exhibition is titled Beyond the Black Panther, Visions of Afrofuturism in American Comics, and it opens this Tuesday. There was a book that's mentioned in the exhibition that I really fell in love with that I think touches on some of the themes you're talking about. It's called The Invention of E.J. Whitaker by the Gibbs sisters, Shawnee and Chantel. Could you tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. The Invention of E.J. Whitaker is a great comic by, as you say, the Gibbs sisters. And it tells the story of a Black female inventor at a period that you might not associate with Black female invention, which is the early 20th century. She actually lives on the campus of Tuskegee University. And the Gibbs sisters actually, as they were researching this book, visited Tuskegee. Tuskegee, of course, is the home and a university created by Booker T. Washington. And in the story, E.J. is the daughter of a professor, a plant biology professor, actually. But she herself is an inventive genius who's created a flying machine, a robot, and many other things. And you're in the story finding out about her and some of the stir that she created with a new flying machine that she's been testing out. And people are looking for her, and they're looking for that flying machine. So I promised every one of the creators I wouldn't give away too much of the story in this exhibit. So if you're interested, you can buy that comic on Comixology, or you can go to their website, Bebop Books, and get the first issue.
It's such a great book because it has, you know, a real steampunk vibe to it. The art is great. The story's really snappy. And it just feels like such a great example about how ideas about Black futures can come to us through Black history.
Yes. And I think that that's one of the things that inspires all of these books at some level, sometimes very directly, like in that case, or in the case of like Greg Anderson, Elise's Izani, The Werespider, which draws very heavily on folk tales that he heard as a child that come from the Caribbean. It's a supernatural tale, but at the same time, you know, those are the kinds of stories that we all remember hearing from ancestors and you know, grandparents and elder community members when we were kids, like, you know, ghost stories and stories of the past. And he uses that to create a really sort of adventurous father-son story about this sort of African god, which is very, very, very typical to the diaspora in some way. So all of them, I think, touch on this way that we can think about a more diverse and a much more interesting way of thinking about Black culture, Black futures, but also the past, right? Afrofuturism never lets go of the past. It is always engaged in that process of recovery, because that, in fact, is something that people of color in a contemporary moment are engaged in as they try to formulate a more positive future.
Julian, comics is such a thin margin business, despite the fact that we now see graphic novels in bookstores and some titles become million-dollar properties. Most of the people working in comics do an insane amount of work for very little profit. What does the milestone story say to you about Black creators in the industry?
You know, it speaks to the need for Black creators and the black audience, or the audience that looks for diversity, to be more aggressive in that at some level. Milestone was the most successful Black-owned comic book company in history in a very real way, right? They published hundreds of issues of comics over their relatively short period. And comics, as you say, are a very hard business. If a comic book lasts for 20 issues, that's not a bad run, right? Like, the comics that we know are characters that are legacy, right? But they were literally created between 1938 and 1960, a lot of them. But, you know, almost all the characters that are driving our media are that old, right? These independent creators that you can find in smaller publishing companies, they struggle to find the space on the shelf. But that's a complicated exercise, because the comic book shop works on demand. And if you don't know something exists, how do you demand it? I joke with my students, no one randomly tumbles into a comic book shop. If you would end up in a comic book shop, you went there on purpose. You just don't wander in. I mean, it just doesn't happen. You're going there for a comic book, which means that you know that they exist, which means that you found out where that was, which means that you want one. One of the reasons that digital comics and comics in graphic novel form are so important for independent creators is because they are on platforms where people can, in fact, come across them. And past success is a predictor of future success. And so new characters from new creators that are people of color telling different kinds of stories struggle to find space. And that is always been the case. And it continues to be the case. But the difference today is, I think, that you do have these sort of robust digital platforms and a company like Milestone, which had a very innovative distribution deal with one of the major distributors, DC, to get its comics everywhere, they would be taking advantage of the kind of social media, the kind of digital distribution. It's a complicated exercise to be a creator in comics, because that's a very niche business, especially when you're independent, creating characters on your own. And you rely on conventions, you rely on things like Kickstarter, you rely on word of mouth and networks of fans to keep you alive. But right now, we're in this weird place, or perhaps not weird place, but a place where all the desire to see things like Afrofuturism, to see sort of Black speculative work in various forms, are driving people to go out and find this stuff. You know, this exhibit is, in my way of saying, like, as you're consuming this, remember that there's a world of things that you might not see. And if you the names that you see here, when you go and look for them out in the world, they're going to be nestled in a series of communities of creators that might be really interesting for you, right? Like, they might be telling steampunk stories like the Gibbs sisters. They might be telling really sort of sci-fi crime action stories like Jerome Walford. They might be telling sort of like historical adaptations or literary adaptations like John Jennings in Parable of the Sower. But they're doing all that work. All that work is happening all the time out there. So take a moment to explore.
Julian Chambliss is a professor of English at Michigan State University. He also curated Beyond the Black Panther, Visions of Afrofuturism in American Comics from Michigan State University's museum. And the exhibition is virtual. You can check it out on the MSU Museum's website link right now. Julian, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, the COVID pandemic shifts many societal norms, including a move to homeschooling in urban areas.
Getting us mentally prepared for it is more like bracing ourselves and understanding that this is a journey.
More on homeschooling revisioned after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Homeschooling among Black families was on the rise even before COVID-19. Now, the pandemic has forced more and more parents to add teacher and year-round daytime babysitter to their list of roles with their children. Despite the fact that parents don't have to report that they're homeschooling, the number of registered homeschools in Michigan more than doubled this past fall. So what's going on here? Why are parents choosing a more permanent commitment to homeschooling rather than eventually sending their children back to school? And why homeschooling as opposed to virtual learning? Today we're going to hear from two mothers. Both of them are African American, and both are homeschooling advocates, supporting Detroit parents who were new to all this. They may be able to shed some light on what's behind this trend. Salima Ellis is school leader at Universal Minds School of Evolution. Hey, Salima.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
And also with us today is Bernita Bradley. She's the founder of the Engage Detroit Homeschooling Network and a Midwest regional delegate for the National Parents Union. Bernita, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me, April.
So many parents these days doing new things, being both the parent and the teacher. I know you both have a lot of different people in your networks and your friend groups, for that matter. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing as people deal with the dual roles? Bernita, could you start us out?
Yeah, so I think parents are seeing more of a spark in their kids, like something new, right? We're seeing a different side of our kids. It's interesting. This is an interesting journey for us. My daughter asked me to homeschool her in fifth grade, and I was always like, yeah, I'm not about to do that because I don't want to end up your enemy. I don't want to end up your enemy. I don't want us fighting all day, every day. But then I've seen this new spark, right, in her, like a passion for what she likes. And educating that way is totally different for me. It really is. It has made me even see, like, wow, I really wish I had did this 7 years ago when she asked me, because she's in 12th grade now. Mm-hmm.
Salima, do you have anything to share about what you've seen parents going through right now? Maybe parents who had never thought about homeschooling before and just how the dual roles have been posing challenges for them.
Well, one of the things that I noticed is that you asked earlier is why is there suddenly such a big uptake besides just the pandemic? One of the things that I noticed is that our students are still being suspended and expelled from school at extraordinary rates, even though the paradigm of schooling has changed, they're still facing these issues. So I think that has a lot to do with parents deciding that, you know what, maybe it is time to homeschool. And the changes that I see in the students are often that their behavior has improved, home time for home has improved. it's just a big improvement in their behavior when they get to do it at home, especially as we have parents who are learning how to school, because that's the big thing. A lot of parents don't know how to, we don't know how to. I didn't know how to do homeschool when I first started 4 years ago. So after you stop trying to follow the blueprint that you've been given as we grew up in school, for those of us that went to public schools or regular school, and you begin to teach at home and you begin to come up with your own techniques and you see your child thriving with those techniques, I think that gives us more of a push to say, okay, I can do this. My child is thriving and I can do this. This is way better than school.
Salima, what were some of the questions that parents were coming to you with in the earlier days of the pandemic? What questions about homeschooling did they have for you?
The biggest question is probably, where do I begin?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Where do I begin? Yeah. We don't know how to often keep record of assignments. We don't understand the preparation that goes into creating assignments for our youth if we're not going to use prepared assignments. How do I change the paradigm? I try to get the parent to understand that your home isn't the classroom. The whole city is your classroom. Mm-hmm. So they begin to change their paradigm. They don't know where to begin. There are so many programs that offer arts and crafts and sports. And just I try to teach them, use these other resources at your disposal. Half the time they probably just don't know where to begin. But for things that you can't teach them yourselves, there are the resources out there to take some of that off their shoulders.
Yes. Bernita, I heard you nodding there. That resonates with what people were asking you.
Yeah, so a lot of parents were just crying out, right? Because it was not, people were like, oh, I am homeschooling. Like, no, you are pandemic schooling. We were all pandemic schooling last year. If their kids were in a regular school and doing virtual online schooling, that is the furthest thing from homeschooling. And people were really getting it mixed up, thinking this is what homeschooling looked like, I don't want to do it. But again, it was pandemic schooling. So we start having families saying, well, what does real homeschooling look like? And how do I take control of my own child's education? And so with that, we start finding out, how do you, like she said, how do you create a curriculum? If you don't want to use an online curriculum, what would that curriculum be based off of? And how do I even get through this? How do I, it's a paradigm shift of the mind of a parent. It is totally out of the box. Like, unschooling is something that's like, home, like she said, home. If you think you're just going to school your kids in your house, you're doing the same thing as the schools do by keeping them in a straight line. But when you realize that if you're in your backyard and your child has a question about the bumblebees flying around, and you decide to say, well, why does that bumblebee look different? You should look that up. And the child goes and look it up, and that turns into a whole exploration. And then the next summer, you got a bumblebee hive in your backyard with your child, or a bumblebee garden, or whatever you want to call it, that your child has decided to cultivate. Then that's education. Education is everywhere all the time. And it's not a specific time of day. It's no 8 to 4 or 7 to 3. It is literally 9 o'clock at night on a Sunday when a little 7-year-old comes and bring her computer to her mom and say, hey, mom, can you do some math problems with me? Like, these are the type of things that we've had parents coming up saying, like posting photos of their kids in the kitchen with them baking pancakes and really going over scientific, like they're this mad scientist in the kitchen learning how to measure the ingredients from scratch and make different type of pancakes. Like, it becomes fun.
This seems like a very...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, this seems like a very important point to make, that the decision to homeschool is not necessarily going easier than sending your kids to a traditional brick and mortar K through 12, that it may actually require more of an investment than parents have made to this point. How do you get them ready for that, Bernita?
Yeah, so So that investment is more, but when you think about, so before I say how you get them ready, but when you think about the investment of sending your child to school and you constantly getting a phone call, like Salima said, that, oh, you mom, you need to come get your child because we're putting them out. That investment right there is more strenuous on a parent. Like, that's hard when you are trying to work and you are trying to do things and teachers and educators aren't understanding your child. Like, they're not even taking the initiative to think outside of the box with your child. They just want to make education punitive. So that's a different type of preparation and a different type of, you know, something you're going through. But when it comes down to home, getting us mentally prepared for it is more like bracing ourselves and understanding that this is a journey. And the child really kind of like guides the learning, right? We kind of facilitating a process that should be intentional with this child and making it healthy for them, making our spaces different, you know.
It's okay. I got it. Salima, I wanted to ask you, Universal Minds is built around this idea that education should help create and not repair. Could you talk about that model and what it means?
Well, yes. We've had a different age, an epoch, during our time, the Bronze Age, the Golden Age, the Silver Age, and now we're at the age of recycle. So we're at an age where the infrastructure is crumbling, and we're basically educating our children, it seems, to repair a broken and crumbling infrastructure. We can't afford to do that anymore. That is not future thinking for our society. And as a homeschooler parent, I get to teach my student a different narrative that says, we're not here to repair, we're here to create new things. We're here to be creators, because when you have a crumbling infrastructure, it's usually going for a reason.
Can you give us a practical example of what that looks like when you put the theory into practice?
Okay, the theory and the practice is that in 2017, I wrote a grant proposal to Baba Malik Ukini, who runs D-Town Farms, to allow us at Inhalation to use his farm. We are growing wildflowers. We were growing all the flowers that entail herbal usage. And the students were to help grow the flowers, learn how to dry them, make teas, herbs, and tinctures. Instead of always going to the doctor, they would get these helpful and useful medical experiences with natural and organic methods of keeping themselves healthy. So not only did they learn how to grow their own healing herbs, they learned how to, we also volunteered on the farm and cleaned up for harvest festival, so they got volunteering in. They understand that if you want to keep your community clean, they do volunteer work to help clean up their lots. So that's my students were able to, that's a futuristic way of teaching them, instead of saying just go to the doctor when you don't feel well.
One of the critiques of modern education is that it can be really disconnected from the things that students actually need to know to, you know, to be functional and productive adults in their lives. There are kids who go to traditional K-12 schools who never make it into a college track because, you know, their grades may go off the rails, or they may be treated differently than other students early on. And likewise, it may be that they're expected to sit in a classroom for 8 or 9 hours a day learning things that won't eventually have very much to do with what they will do for a living and the challenges that they will face when they grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Bernita, are there some ways that homeschooling can help us address this?
Yeah, so I'll speak to that from two perspectives. So if you think about the Finland model of schools, most of their kids that graduate by the time they're in 11th, they really graduate around 11th grade, 10th and 11th grade. And their last 2 years of school, they are spent exploring what they love, not just a traditional track to college. Our schools here don't do that. They want kids to just get a regular basic high school education and move on, right? In homeschooling, you find what your children are passionate about. We have a mom whose daughters have been doing making jewelry from old broken up jewelry and purchasing new items. And they've created these beautiful, beautiful bracelets, earrings, and things like that, right? But their mom is not just using it as something, hey, go make jewelry to have some fun. She's using it as a business model for them. They're taking business classes. They're taking financial literacy classes. They are also learning how to save. They're learning economical growth. Like what would it take if I save this money over a course of time and then eventually buy my own machines to make my own jewelry? And what are some other options out here if I wanted to open up a storefront, or do I want to do a pop-up? So it becomes learning. And they're doing that to really get those kids to think, is this something I really might want to do long-term, right? And same thing with my daughter. My daughter does nails, and she's like just been exploring nails. So we purchased her online quick nail course over the last year. So she's evolving with nails. And we're not just saying like, this is something, just buy some nails and tinker with it. No, if you're going to do it, be the best at what you want to do at it and learn how to do it a professional way. Now, it'll let her know if she really wants to go to nail school, right? Whereas, and these are all non-traditional ways of going to college and getting a degree that can actually make you some real money or a certification, right?
Right.
But too often, we want to make children only think about being a doctor or only think about being a lawyer. That's fine, because guess what? Most of us, we changed our profession when we got older too. If you want to be a nail tech today and a brain surgeon in 10 years, I'm good with it, right? But do what makes you happy right now. And it's not like you can't be a brain surgeon 10 years from now. So, yeah, I think it's thinking out of the box. Everything we're doing is thinking non-traditionally. We have to think non-traditionally. Because the school has thought traditionally for a long time for us. And now we only have in Detroit 16% of our kids reading on grade level by third grade. So that right there in and of itself, and that's not a public school thing. That's all schools in Detroit. So if we're not thinking out of the box on how to get kids to learn and how to get them to read and understand and retain what they're learning, then we're doing an injustice.
Salima, how the families that you work with, how do you talk to them about thinking through students' long-term options and really helping their homeschooling relate to the things that they'll be doing when they're beyond school?
That is one of the most difficult things to help parents do, think in long-term options. Because basically we have a school system that is ran by the millionaires. Whatever they say they need that workforce to produce, that's usually how our schools have been going. So when you are given the option to homeschool, and now it becomes up to the parent and the student to think in the long-term future, you have to think on what would add value to your student? What would make your student valuable in the long term, in the future? What is it that they're going to be learning? We have to be able to educate our students in a way where they have skills that help them well into the future and skills that they can pass down to their own students. And that's one of the most difficult parts of being a homeschool parent, is how do you develop those skills so that you can help your student create and cultivate skills that won't just bring him an income, him or her income, but that will help cultivate their community, their surroundings.
My guests today have been Salima Ellis of Universal Minds School of Evolution and Bernita Bradley of the Engage Detroit Homeschooling Network. Ladies, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're looking for more information about making the leap to homeschooling and the Engage Detroit Homeschooling Network, visit michiganradio.org and click Stateside. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for being here. We'll see you tomorrow.